You know, in its 50 years of existence, the Booker Prize now, the man Booker, has generated its fair share of upsets and bust-ups. Judges have sulked, thrown punches, threatened to hurl themselves off balconies, and authors such as Anthony Burgess have thrown infamous tantrums or caused controversy, like my old Marxist friend John Berger back in 72. He spurned the award and donated half of the prize money to the Black Panthers. But amidst all the controversy that has raged over the five decades, there seems to be one thing everyone agrees on, and that is that the Booker boosts book sales. Last year's winner, George Saunders' Lincoln on the Bardo, shot up the bestseller charts with sales increasing over 1,000%. In other words, if you're a relatively unknown author before the Man Booker, you're pretty much guaranteed to wake up an international celebrity the morning after. Without further ado, let's wing our way to the UK, where Michael Caine's assistant editor of that invaluable organ, the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, is sitting in our London studio perusing this year's winning book. Michael, welcome.
Thanks very much indeed.
Michael, first of all, who was Booker?
Well, Booker PLC in 1968 went into league with Tom Mashler, a young publisher working for Jonathan Cape in London, and founded this incredible prize. As you said, it's been going for 50 years. The idea was to emulate France's Prix Goncourt. They wanted to create a prize that would get everyone talking about serious fiction. And there were lots of prizes around in Britain at the time, but nothing that quite did the same thing, nothing that quite had that same impact. Now, Booker were a firm that had dealt in sugar and rum, mining machinery. They also, very strangely, a really odd addition to their stable, held the rights to the James Bond books, to Ian Fleming's novels. So they already had an established literary interest. Mashler knew that. And with various other parties, they came together and started working on this prize.
And the man part?
The man is a much later edition. It's come in recent times, obviously about, I think, about a dozen years ago. The Man Group is kind of hedge fund managing the Booker Group as it was in the 60s is long gone. The Man Group is a vastly powerful organization, and it's partly responsible for the tilt towards the American market that the Man Booker Prize now has.
So, Man Booker 2018, is it an upset, a bust-up, a surprise win, or none of the above?
Well, strangely enough, I think it could be described as a bust-up avoided. It's really none of the above. Anna Burns has won it for her fourth novel, Milkman. And it's easy to say in retrospect, but I think there are maybe four good reasons for thinking it was a strong contender. It's serious and stylish. It might be challenging at first sight. You know, it's made up of quite what look like long, dense paragraphs, unbroken up by obvious divisions. But actually, it's quite easy once you get into it. So it's serious, but it's readable. And that's a classic Booker combination. The other thing, it's historical. And the Man Booker Prize has strong form on supporting historical fiction over the years. I would say it's important to look at the judges. One of them, Val McDermid, is known as a crime novelist, and I would say this has got quite an ominous atmosphere. It's got a creepy atmosphere. I can see that appealing to her, apart from anyone else. And the fourth sign, I would say, is that even before it's won the prize, Milkman has been a very strong seller in Ireland. I think there was a point, it's an Irish novel, it's set in Belfast during the Troubles in the 1970s. And it seems to have struck a chord. I think there was a stage when it was outselling the rest of the shortlist combined in Ireland. So that's a word of mouth is a really strong sign, I think, that a book really does, you know, strike a chord, and it's a serious contender.
Does it also not press the Me Too button?
Yeah, it's really interesting that the chair of judges, the writer and philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, referred to that. He referred to the Me Too movement. I personally, I feel that's that's interesting because he talked about the whole shortlist as representing these dark times. So he's referring Milkman to where we are now. But actually reading it, I don't really have that same feeling. I think retrospectively, yes, it's got something to do. You can see it's leading towards this moment. But it's so strong in the atmosphere of the 1970s in Ireland. To me, that's more important.
Okay, Anna Burns grew up in Belfast. To what extent is this a biographical work?
Well, she left Belfast, I think, in the mid-80s, and she's lived in England ever since. But her experiences, I think, growing up in Belfast during these awful times lies really deep in her imagination. It's there in her first novel, a really good one called No Bones. If you've already read Milkman, or if you like Milkman, No Bones is a great place to go next. It's also about a young girl growing up in Belfast during the Troubles. And it's one of these things where I think it's important to her, to Anna Burns, to have time to contemplate and draw on things that lie in the past. She was interviewed for the TLS website, and she said, I'm not so interested in work that draws on raw experience. She doesn't sound to me like the kind of writer who's going to be out there twittering and, you know, tweeting about her thoughts the moment she's had them. I think she likes to let things kind of just ferment for a while. So I think it's absolutely central to the way she writes.
I have to ask you whether Julian Barnes is right when he, of course, called it a posh lottery. Oh, in 1996, A.L. Kennedy dismissed the book as being all about, and I quote, who knows who, who's sleeping with who, who's selling drugs to who, who's married to who, and whose turn is it? Any element of truth?
Well, historically, yes, we certainly know that's true. We know about Larkin, Philip Larkin, when he was chair of judges, threatening to jump out of the window, I think, if his friend, Barbara Pym, wasn't put on the shortlist. And we know that Elizabeth Jane Howard, when she was on the jury, was terribly keen to have her husband, Kingsley Amis, on the shortlist for a novel called Ending Up, which I don't think is his strongest. He won it the following decade. So that's definitely going on. But I think that, to concentrate on that A.L. Kennedy line, at least there, I think she's missing a deeper lying scandal, which is that we're all kind of in this together. You get four or five, six people in a room. Imagine it's a Venn diagram. The winner is the book that they can all agree on. It's the one in the middle. So there is always this danger. It's the boring choice. It's the compromise choice. We've had a bit of that. So there is scandal. There's definitely been nepotism. I can't speak for this year, at least as far as I know. But there's this other thing going on as well.
Michael, being provincial, I must make the point, proudly, that Australians have done pretty well in the Man Booker, and two friends of mine and the program in Richard Flanagan and Peter, of course, are multiple winners. I don't think they'd be all that thrilled that the Man Booker has been opened to Americans.
This is absolutely one of the great Booker scandals of recent times. It's a long story, really, which I didn't go into entirely, but there was always a sense that the Booker was there as a marketing tool, and there's a pragmatic aspect to the rules about who it was open to. It's been open to South African writers. It's mainly, you know, it's open, we think of it as being, I don't know, a London phenomenon. Yes, these wonderful Australian writers, I think wonderful Australian writers, have won it more than once. Wonderful writers from India as well. There was a strange period when of uncertainty. They opened it up to the Americans. And ever since, I think, really, there's been complaints about it, both from publishers and from authors themselves, including past winners, who don't think it's a very good idea. I know Peter Carey himself has said it's not a very good idea at all. At the beginning of the year, there was a very strange incident where some British publishers got together, produced a group letter addressed to the Booker Foundation, saying you must change the rules or we're going to risk a homogenised literary future. And that seems to me exactly what the Booker ought not to stand for. This is a real danger now.
I love some of the stories, like when the jury was terrorised by Dame Rebecca West, who glowered over anyone daring to offer an opinion that differed from hers. How do you get on the judging panel?
Well, it's very strange, actually. I was thinking on my way to the studio, there's quite a few people who've judged the prize and then gone on to be contenders. Maybe not winners, but they've been shortlisted. And I think the other way around, too. That's another sign that we're kind of all in it together. They like to create a healthy mixture, shall we say, a kind of cross-section of different kinds of readers. They might choose an academic who is known for sound judgment or something like that. Somebody, a politician who might be good at chairing meetings. Somebody else a bit more of a wild card. Joanna Lumley was very funny about it. She chaired it she didn't chair it. She was on the jury in the 1980s and basically dismissed it as being this awful experience, and all literary people were terrible piranhas. There was a time when Rabbi Julia Neuberger just walked off the panel, I think. She thought the winner, James Kelman's How Late It Was, was just crap. She just said it's crap and it's a disgrace. So there has been... Sorry, do go on.
No. Almost every prize I've looked at over many years, and I've been very much involved, for example, in film awards, has been contentious in one way or another. And we look back on many with great embarrassment. I mean, think of all the dreadful films that have won the Oscar, you know, bypassing much worthier efforts. Can you think of some books that really deserved to win that didn't?
I think they come around probably every year. I mean, I can think of novels that, in my view, are stinkers and aren't going to stand the test of time. I mean, who can say? I think Vernon Godlittle or Paul Scott Staying On isn't his strongest novel, but it won the Booker. There's that kind of thing. But the other sign about a really good books, novels coming round that deserve more recognition is that the Booker has led to the establishment of other prizes. There was a time when it was thought that men were dominating the lists, and that led to the creation of the Women's Prize. We now have in England the Goldsmiths Prize, which is meant to reward avant-garde fiction, kind of progressive fiction, things that maybe the man Booker can't quite touch because it needs to be marketable, needs to be readable. So I think there's lots of different titles like that. I would say here, Eamon McBride's Girl is a Half-Formed Thing is an obvious example of one that should have won.
And does the TLS give it a lot of coverage, finally?
You know, we used to be, I look back through the archives at this because I'm trying to work on my own book about the book, about prizes in general. I want to call it Posh Bingo, which is from that Julian Barnes piece you mentioned. Posh Bingo, what a phrase for it. And we used to be very sniffy about it. I think, as you mentioned, you asked about where judges come from. Well, partly they turn out to be sometimes TLS critics. So we're closer to the prize than we think.
Thank you, Michael, for sharing your literary insights. Michael Caines, assistant editor of the Times Literary Supplement.